This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After 2 years in legal limbo, the captives at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base may slowly be nearing some sort of reckoning. Earlier this month, the United States Supreme Court agreed to hear arguments on whether detainees can challenge their status in the federal courts. The Bush administration argues that the U.S. legal system has no jurisdiction over the prisoners and that keeping them within the military system is vital to the prosecution of the war on terror. That case and the stories of the handful of detainees who have been released are sure to renew debate over the extent of executive powers. Later in the program, we'll bring you an update on today's terrorist attacks in Spain. But first, the legal status of the prisoners at Guantanamo and the case coming up before the Supreme Court. If you have questions about the legal situation of the prisoners, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from the grounds of the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba is NPR reporter Jackie Northam. And Jackie, welcome.
Thank you very much, Neil. Hi.
You're in Guantanamo as part of a press tour, right? What have you been able to see so far?
Well, you're right. I am part of a press tour, and I tell you, they keep you very tightly controlled around here. Anywhere you want to go by yourself, you are with a minder. So security is one thing, and they're also, you know, they're also cautious about what exactly gets out. We have seen a lot in the days that we've been here, but I think probably the most important and enlightening has been Camp Delta, which is where the detainees are being held. It's actually broken into four camps, one, two, three, and four. And three, two, and one, don't let the numbers confuse you as they did us, but three, two, and one are maximum security. This is where the detainees that have been brought in off the battlefield, this is where they're put through. Camp four is a medium security. And it's quite interesting what they told us about how you move from one camp to another. It's all a system of incentives and rewards. So in other words, if you're a good behavior, you might get a bottle of water instead of having running water from the tap, things like that, or shampoo. You might be able to get out a little bit longer. You know, in the first couple camps, they're out, it's at least 30 minutes a day, if not 30 minutes every other day. By the time you're in camp four, you can get outside of your cell about 8 hours a day. So it's a system that they have, again, of incentives and rewards based on behavior, certainly based on how much information you will be, the detainees give the interrogators.
Have you and the other reporters been able to see the detainees or even talk to them? Were you able to get a sense of what their situation is?
Yes, we were able to see them. We certainly are not allowed to talk to them. And the detainees don't even try to talk to us because I think in the past when they've had press groups here and they have tried to talk to them, the journalists have been ejected from the island, not just Camp Delta itself. So I think everybody is pretty aware that that's something you do not do. Did see probably about two dozen of them again, and this is in Camp 4, the medium security area. You know, they've got good weight on them. They look well cared for, and I think part of that is the medical facilities here are astonishing, and what, you know, probably half of America would like to have is their medical facilities. They take good care of them that way. You know, again, I think this is something you're going to bring up in your show. It's not that I don't think anybody thinks they're maltreated physically here by any stretch, but it's just this open-ended detention that seems to be the problem. And they do say that there are people that suffer from detention or depression, because of that, that sense of really not knowing what the future is.
Indeed, the International Committee of the Red Cross, in a rare public statement in such cases, said they believe the legal limbo that all of these people were in contributed to a deterioration of their mental condition. What do the American authorities you talk to respond to that? How do they respond to that?
You know, this is something that they really, they tell you right out that they don't want to respond to that. That isn't in their realm of knowledge or certainly anything that they can comment on. If they do say something, it's really, look, these are people that tried to kill us. And so these are people that we want to interrogate, and we do not want to put them on the battlefield. We want to hold them. We want to question them until we find out as much possible information as we can. Now, again, that's the military here. That's their angle. Mm-hmm. Of course, the other angle is the open-ended detentions.
Now, is there any way of gauging how many prisoners are in that medium security facility with a little bit more freedom, and how many are in the maximum security facilities?
Right. There's about 640 prisoners in Camp Delta itself. They come from at least four, and you know, depending who's coming and who's gone, at least 40 different nations with, you know, about 17 different languages, they say. In Camp 4, again, the medium security, there's about 100 prisoners there. And they're very careful, they say, about trying to mix them into the, you know, the right nationalities and cultures and that type of thing. They're careful with that. There's also one other camp I didn't mention, and this is Camp Echo. Now, this is, they did not take us out there, but this is where the six men that are being held, that are being deemed eligible to face a military commission, and that includes the two that have already been charged, a Sudanese man and a man from Yemen. So they're in another camp off, and they won't really tell us where that is, but you know, it's somewhere on this base, and this base is about 45 miles. Huge security on this base again. So that's the fifth camp. But everybody else, they have about 100 to 150 in each of the camps.
And at Camp Echo, again, is that where the courtroom has been built for any possible military tribunals or eventual military tribunals?
That's right, and it's very funny because the Pentagon says, yes, there is the courtroom, and it is there, and it's built. When you get here, they say, well, they haven't said for sure that it's going to happen here yet. So there's always this trickle-down information problem you get between the Pentagon and the people at Guantanamo Bay. But there is a courthouse. It's a two-story office building, and it was built already. This is, you know, the Americans have had this this base for, you know, quite a number of decades now, and so it was there. It sits on top of a bluff overlooking the whole Guantanamo Bay area. It's bright yellow, so it's been called the Yellow Office Building. That is where the tribunals will take place, according to the Pentagon, not the people here. But they did describe the room to us here. They won't take us in. But basically, it's really sort of unimpressive. It's, you know, wooden chairs. There's no, you know, there's not a judge. There's a review panel. And, you know, it's just a table where the people who will judge the prisoners will sit. It's just a very inauspicious room and not very big as well.
Now,
they also have built a...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go on, Neil. I was going to say they've built a sally port on back just for more security on back of the courthouse, but otherwise the courthouse was already there.
Mm-hmm. As you've mentioned, this is a fairly large military facility, 45 square miles or so. A lot more goes on there than just the activities with the detainees.
There's a lot. I mean, this is an interesting situation here. It's a joint task force, so it's just not the Navy, it's not the Coast Guard, it's not the Army. It's a combination. So there's even things with immigration. I mean, if they're putting up barbed wire and that, and looking at building camps in case the Haitians start coming in en masse here. There's drug interdiction. There's a lot of things, and there's a lot of personnel here now. There's about 2,500 military personnel now on the naval base, and before it was just a sleepy little naval base, and they were pretty much tearing it down until 9/11 happened, and they decided this is where we're going to hold them.
Now, Jackie, you've been covering this story for a while from afar. Now that you're there at Guantanamo Bay, what's your impression?
It makes a huge difference to always get a sense, you know, to get on the ground, to take a look at the landscape, if not the feeling, and also to see, I mean, physically, where the detainees are being held and under what conditions are being held. Their cells are wire mesh, sort of pretty much like a chain link fence. So it's all open. There's no privacy in that. We got to see that. We got to hear some of them in the background praying. All this really helps to give you a sense that, you know, a better sense of who these people are and that. But what we really haven't, I mean, the military has tried to show us that it's a very good life for the troops that are here, the American military, but we still haven't got to the nub of, you know, the detainees themselves, and that they, you know, what they're being held on, and they're not being charged, they don't have right to counsel. That really hasn't been broached yet, and that's what we go back and just incorporate everything we've seen here with the knowledge we're getting from Washington and the Pentagon and that type of thing.
Jackie Northam, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks very much, Neil.
NPR's Jackie Northam with us from the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. And now we cross the Atlantic to England. Five British detainees who had been held at Guantanamo Bay were returned home earlier this week. Four were arrested upon arrival last night. British authorities freed them and said they will not be filing charges against any of the men. NPR's Emily Harris is on the story. And Emily, hello.
Hello, Neil.
And I understand the men live in Tipton, which is outside of London?
Three of the five men who were released from prison in Guantanamo Bay live in Tipton, which is actually a suburb of Birmingham, just a couple of hours north of London in central Britain. There's a large Muslim community in this area, and they have been called variously, depending on the political perspective of the publication in England, either the Tipton Three, the three men from here, or the Taliban Tipton.
Now, you're on their way to their houses, right?
That's right. I'm in Tipton now, and am on my way to their houses, where I gather a large number of reporters have been waiting for some time now, all day, from what I gather from reports I've been seeing during the day. The men were released late last night, and police took them to undisclosed locations of their choices to meet with their families. There is a tremendous interest among the British media in particular to get their stories, to find out what it was like in Guantanamo Bay, and talk of a great sums of money being exchanged for their stories. So right now, some of that negotiation is apparently going on while the people who were released from Guantanamo Bay are remaining in undisclosed locations rather than turning back up at their houses.
So far, all we've seen is statements from their lawyers.
Statements from their lawyers and a few statements from some relatives. The sister of one of them have said that her brother had a horrific story to tell. Lawyers for some of the former detainees were complaining about the fact that they were interrogated by British police. Four of them were four were arrested, all were questioned after they landed and after they had been in U.S. custody for 2 years. One lawyer also said that he gathered from his clients that Guantanamo Bay was an experiment in interrogation, and he promised that his clients had some good stories to tell. I mean, there's been about 100 people released from Guantanamo Bay, but not a lot of details have emerged about exactly what it's like there in daily life, what kind of interrogation techniques, what kind of focus the interrogation has. So perhaps some of these five men will be able to shed some light on what life was like there.
Well, what's been the reaction, the public reaction, to not only to the men's return, but to the news that they've been released and aren't going to be charged?
Yeah, a mix. I mean, there's sort of a bit of bewilderment among a lot of the people I've talked to who say they're free. They weren't charged with anything after being held for 2 years. So there's a little confusion about why. There's some people who are feel that this just shows that the Guantanamo Bay custody system is somewhat of a farce, because they were held for 2 years, and then after 24 hours, the British police couldn't find anything to hold them on. I should make it clear that some British officials were involved in questioning these men in Guantanamo Bay, but it's unlikely that any evidence surfacing from there would be usable in a British court. Also, there are some people here who, although there's a wide dislike for the Guantanamo system in Britain, of no lawyers, no charges, etc., there also are a number of people here who do wonder what these young men were doing in Afghanistan during this time of war, and certainly would like to know more about that before they decide how they feel about them not being charged with anything.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil.
NPR's Emily Harris with us on the phone from Tipton, England, where she hopes to hear more from the British men who were released from Guantanamo Bay earlier this month. When we come back from a break, we'll talk about the legal status of the detainees still in Guantanamo Bay, and we'll take your calls on these issues. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Also, later in the program, an update on today's terrorist attacks in Madrid, Spain. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're discussing the tough legal questions raised by the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The Pentagon is moving to begin at least some military tribunals. At the same time, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a legal challenge from prisoners held at the base. You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us to discuss the case is Eugene Fidel, president of the National Institute of Military Justice. He joins us from his offices here in Washington, D.C. Nice of you to be with us today.
My pleasure, Neil.
And also with us is Robert Turner, co-founder of the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia, and he's with us from the Army-Navy Club, also in Washington, D.C., and good of you to be with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Neil.
Robert Turner, let's start with you. Is there historic or legal precedent for keeping these trials within the military system?
There's not only historic precedent, there is a requirement. If these people qualified as prisoners of war under the Third Geneva Convention, which they don't, but we are giving them the basic protections, and they certainly are entitled to no greater protections, the Geneva Conventions require that if captured detainees are tried, that it be done by military tribunal.
And so that's the legal precedent, and they're being described by the administration as enemy combatants. But Eugene Fidel, these men have been held for 2 years without charge, without access to lawyers for the most part.
Well, you don't have a right to a lawyer simply because you're in detention, or if you were a POW, you wouldn't have a right to a lawyer per se. If I can comment on one thing that Bob Turner mentioned. Bob, may I?
Of course.
There is a lot of ifs anytime you raise questions about this subject or discuss this subject, but if, as Bob points out, these people were POWs, then they would have a right to trial if you were going to try them rather than simply hold them by a military court. But I think I would respectfully disagree that it would be a military commission. I actually think it would be a general court-martial. But the administration's position is none of these people are POWs, so that becomes a kind of academic issue.
Robert Turner, let me ask you about that phrase, enemy combatants. Is that an expression that is new?
I don't think it's a new expression. It's an old concept, certainly. When historically, the early practice was when one military force defeated another, they would slaughter all the soldiers, and then somebody said, well, let's make them slaves instead. We can sell them or use them. And finally, nations got together and started reaching agreements and said, let's instead just warehouse them until the conflict is over, and then we'll send them home. They're not considered wrongdoers. They're entitled to humane treatment and a variety of other protections, but those protections don't include a day in court or access to a lawyer. Or we had our first POW in Vietnam, Elvin Alvarez, was shot down in August of 1964, was released in January of 1973. And that whole time, we never once claimed he had a right to a lawyer or a judicial hearing. He was held as a prisoner of war, and these people are being held in the same kind of situation. It's not exactly the same because Al-Qaeda is not a sovereign state, and I think a pretty strong case can be made that the Taliban was not a sovereign state, although it was in control of parts of a sovereign state. But certainly these people aren't entitled to greater protections than would be given to a military officer or enlisted man who obeyed the laws of armed conflict.
Eugene Fidel, let me come back quickly on that, and then we'll get some calls in. If it was a war against Afghanistan, prisoners of war are supposed to be let go when the war is over. Afghanistan's government, the Taliban, has been defeated, yet there's a greater war on terror. If that's the war, it who knows when it may
end? Well, that's one of the things that I think has had people on edge, let's say. It's the notion that this particular kind of detention might last till the end of time, assuming that you apply concepts of law, of war, rather, to the current struggle. By the way, it apparently is and this is a new recognition on my own part, it seems to be a better question than I originally thought as to whether the Taliban functioned as an Afghan state army. My own thinking is evolving on this, but whether the Taliban even in theory ever qualified as the Afghan army is something that I think we're going to have to give some further thought to.
We have the UN Security Council passed a resolution instructing states under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter that they would not recognize the Taliban as a government of Afghanistan. Only one state did at the end, and only three states total. But the key issue, it's very clear that the Taliban militia did not think of themselves as the army of the state of Afghanistan. And in fact, they didn't hold commissions issued by that state. They didn't function as a national army. They were the enforcement arm of a religious movement that had taken control of parts of the country. And you know, I think a strong case can be made that they were not the army of Afghanistan. They did not behave as an army. Mm-hmm. They grossly violated the most fundamental rules of international law in terms of attacking noncombatants and, you know, killing civilians and supporting terrorism and so forth. And the idea that we confuse them, and especially al-Qaeda, with soldiers is, in my view, an insult to every man who ever wore a uniform and honorably for any country in the world.
Let's get some...
It's clear, if I can, just kneel for one
Well, we
second.
Really wanted to get some listeners' questions
okay,
in, so
go ahead.
Why don't we do that?
Sure.
Let's begin with John, and John is with us from Lewiston, New York.
Hi. Quick question for you. I teach a freshman and sophomore class at a local university. The book we use is called The Logic of American Politics, and we just got done doing the federal court system in the United States, so it's timely, I guess. The chart actually shows that the military courts of the United States ultimately have to be responsive to the edicts of the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that, in fact, the case? I guess my question would be is, as we rise through the appellate division in civil courts, and it gets to the federal appellate division, ultimately that goes to the Supreme Court. But this chart in the book, and we just studied it a week ago, also shows that the military court decisions are ultimately decided one way or the other by the Supreme Court if they decide to hear the case.
Well, I think what you have to do is distinguish between the court-martial system, which is the one that really applies to our own personnel, and this other system of justice that's evolved under the military commission's order that President Bush issued in November 2001. Certainly, court-martial cases can now, for the last 20 years or so, get to the Supreme Court of the United States. On the other hand, the military commission process does not have review in the federal courts, much less in the U.S. Supreme Court. The government has been resisting habeas corpus review, and that is one of the issues that's going to be decided at the end of this Supreme Court term in late June.
I'm glad it's going to be decided. I think it's right for the court to look at it, but there is strong precedent from the Supreme Court in favor of what the government is doing. For example, in the Johnson versus Eisentrager case in 1950, Justice Jackson, speaking for the court, said executive power over enemy aliens, undelayed and unhampered by litigation, has been deemed throughout our history essential to wartime security. And in that case and in many other cases, the court held that enemy aliens, or even non-enemy aliens outside the United States who, you know, are not in sovereign territory or not U.S. persons, have no habeas corpus right, and certainly international law recognizes no such right, since habeas corpus is basically a British and American creation.
Eugene Fridell, let me also ask, following up on John's question, a panel of four civilians has been named by the Secretary of Defense, led by former Attorney General Griffin Bell. These are distinguished people, and again, all civilians, with at least limited appellate powers to review the cases that would go before these military tribunals.
Right. The four people are Attorney General Bell, William T. Coleman, who is a very distinguished American attorney, previously served as Secretary of Transportation, the Chief Justice of Rhode Island, and Judge Beister of the Pennsylvania State Courts. They will be a review panel, and they're actually going to be commissioned temporarily as military officers. I wonder if they'll have to go out and buy uniforms. They're not a court. They don't have the kind of independence that, for example, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces would have. Is it a step in the right direction? Of course. At least it's better to have some appellate review than none. But this is still internal to the Defense Department apparatus, and that has some people uncomfortable.
These are three tremendously distinguished jurists. Again, you know, most of them former high-level, either current or high-level judges. Griffin Bell, in addition to being Attorney General, was on the Fifth Circuit. But they have the power to look at a case after it's been decided and totally dismiss the charges if they find unwarranted, or they can return the case for a retrial. The one thing they can't do is look at a trial where someone has been found not guilty and instruct a verdict of guilty. They can't hurt a defendant, but they can totally overturn the decision if they so wish. It's a tremendously blue ribbon group, and to say that people like Griffin Bell are going to be somehow intimidated by the Pentagon in terms of not doing justice is shocks me.
John,
you didn't say that, I know, but for anyone to say that, this is a very independent review and certainly is not required by international law, but is a good thing.
John, thanks very much for the call. Here's an email question from Charles Winters in Kansas City, Missouri, and I think this goes to you, Robert Turner. Hang on, he says, POWs do not get interrogated, so to suggest that these people in Guantanamo get more rights than POWs is not true.
Well, it's simply not true that POWs don't get interrogated. The Third Geneva Convention says they cannot be compelled to provide more than their name, rank, serial number, fundamental issue. But POWs are routinely interrogated. You cannot torture them. That's protected by the Third Convention and by a variety of international human rights treaties and conventions. But you certainly can interrogate them at length, and if they provide information, you can use that information.
Okay, let's go to Ken, and Ken's with us from Ithaca, New York.
Thank you, Neil. The show is tackling a fascinating and important topic. So here's my question. The government isn't always correct, even when it's absolutely certain of its intelligence. So why doesn't the presumption of innocence apply to these wartime prisoners, including apparently some who are U.S. citizens?
None of the U.S. citizens are in Guantanamo Bay. That's a separate case, and let's not open that can of worms today. We've discussed it before. We will again. But Eugene Fidel, why don't you tackle that?
Sure. There is a presumption of innocence,
exactly.
And indeed, the burden of proof, the normal burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, is required under the instructions that the Pentagon has put in place. So you really do have to read the fine print on that subject.
But
that's not to say the system is perfect. Nobody claims it's perfect. But, the rudiments of our normal criminal justice process are there.
But how can these prisoners defend themselves if they haven't been charged and aren't given access to attorneys?
Once
that's
they're charged,
question.
They will be given attorneys. And,
yeah.
By the way, the attorneys who've been appointed, the people chosen by the military, a couple of them are former students of mine and several former colleagues. They are first-rate people, top graduates. The chief defense counsel, Will Gunn, is a cum laude graduate, Harvard Law School, was selected one of the 40 lawyers under 40 by the National Law Journal, is in the Hall of Fame of the Military Law Section of the Bar Association. These are excellent, distinguished military lawyers. And they will, they've already filed the defense lawyers have filed a brief, an amicus brief with the Supreme Court showing how far they're willing to go to try to defend their clients. These people are going to get wonderful representation.
But isn't it unusual to hold people for years before allowing that process to move forward?
As soon as they're charged, the process will move forward. Until they are charged, while they're held as POW, or essentially as enemy combatants during a period of armed conflict, they have no right to a trial, just like almost nobody listening to this program today under the Sixth Amendment has a right to a speedy and public trial or a lawyer. It's only when you're accused of a felony. The Sixth Amendment begins, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial, et cetera, and so forth.
And Ken, I think the Supreme Court is going to be deciding about that limbo period in between those two things, and that's the case that's up before them. Thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Robert Turner of the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia and with Eugene Fidel of the National Institute for Military Justice, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email question we have from Ben in Ann Arbor, Michigan. What if covert black ops special forces members were captured while undertaking secret missions in another nation? Would those men be held to the same standards as the people in Guantanamo? A friend of mine had a brother in a special forces unit. He told me his brother was often involved in secret missions in Colombia and Peru. Could this man be held incommunicado as the Guantanamo prisoners are? Eugene Fidel?
The answer is people who undertake that kind of mission realize that they're putting themselves at grave risk. And I think that, number one, is a tribute to those patriotic Americans who do that kind of work. These are tremendously courageous people. Many of the forces that we contend with around the world cannot be counted on to honor every jot and tittle of international law. While I have the floor, let me just mention one thing that I think this particular, I guess, email listener will want to take a look at. There's a recent article by Hayes Parks of the Department of Defense on special forces wearing of non-standard uniforms. That's completely fascinating. It deals with the legal implications of what happens when our people or the other side go native in terms of how they dress and what are the legal implications of that. This is an era of special forces operations, particularly highly unconventional types of operations, and I commend that reader's attention to this. It's in the fall 2003 issue of the Chicago Journal of International Law.
I agree with everything you've just said, and Hayes Parks is one of my dearest friends, and he's a combat veteran from Vietnam before he went to law school, and certainly one of the foremost people in the world as an expert in this area. So it's a superb article. I highly commend it.
Let's see if we get one more caller in. Ed is with us from San Antonio, Texas. Ed, are you there? Ed is apparently no longer with us. And
be persuaded.
Bill joins us from Philadelphia.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to open up the can of worms of the legal definition of war. You touched on that if they were enemy combatants or soldiers of a Taliban, a sovereign state, when that conflict is over, they should be returned. But if they're being held in the broader war on terrorism, who determined that that's actually a war? As far as I know, Congress didn't authorize an official war on terrorism. It was a semantic decision by the administration, just like a war on drugs. A Colombian drug cartel lord picked
up. Actually, Bill, you're mistaken. Congress passed a statute, a joint resolution, authorizing the use of military force in the war on terrorism. The UN Security Council, I think by a unanimous vote, acting under Chapter 7, recognized that measures of self-defense were authorized in response to terrorist attacks. It clearly is a war in the lower, you know, in the small W sense. Now, in the concept of why didn't we declare war, the basic answer to that, although it might be another program, is that the power of Congress to declare war, very much like the power of Congress to issue or grant letters of marque and reprisal, a process that went out in the 19th century, has been overtaken by events. Declarations of war were associated with aggressive war or you know, offensive hostilities under what we call jus ad bellum law, the law of initiation of coercion. That's been outlawed, and no one has declared war in, you know, since the 1940s. So, but the Congress, in fact, in I think it was 1801 or 1802, Congress or the Supreme Court held that Congress could authorize war without formally issuing declarations.
Robert Turner, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
That's all right.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Our pleasure.
Robert Turner, Associate Director of the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia, and Eugene Fidel at the National Institute of Military Justice. Both were with us from their offices in Washington. Spain and terrorism, when we come back from a break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.